This was just more of the same, and I was disgusted with myself for not seeing the outcome in advance. In those days, we called someone who did an idiotic thing a dubber, pronounced dubba, if you were from Maine. I had just dubbed up big time. "What I don't understand, Stevie," she said, "is why you'd write junk like this in the first place. You're talented. Why do you want to waste your abilities?" She had rolled up a copy of VIB number 1 and was brandishing it at me, the way a person might brandish a rolled-up newspaper at a dog that had piddled on the rug. She waited for me to answer, to her credit. Boredom can be a very good thing for someone in a creative jam. I spent those walks being bored and thinking about my gigantic boondoggle of a manuscript. For weeks, I got exactly nowhere in my thinking. It all just seemed too hard, too fucking complex. I had run out too many plot lines, and they were in danger of becoming snarled. I circled the problem again and again, beat my fists on it, knocked my head against it. And then, one day when I was thinking of nothing much at all,
the whole darkness about him rang with victory. He started and half raised himself. Had there been any actual sound? Listening hard, he could hear nothing but the low, murmurous noise of warm wind and gentle swell. The suggestion of music must have been from within. But as soon as he lay down again, he felt assured that it was not. From without, most certainly from without, but not by the sense of hearing, festal revelry and dance and splendour poured into him. No sound, yet in such fashion that it could not be remembered or thought of except as music. It was like having a new sense. It was like being present when the morning stars sang together. It was as if Perelandra had that moment been created. And perhaps in some sense it had. The feeling of a great disaster averted was forced upon his mind, and with it came the hope that there would be no second attempt. And then, sweeter than all, the suggestion that he had been brought there not to do anything, but only as a spectator or a witness. A few minutes later, he was asleep. Chapter 9. The weather had changed during the night. Ransom sat looking out from the edge of the forest in which he had slept, on a flat sea where there were no other islands in view. He had waked a few minutes before, and found himself lying alone in a close thicket of stems that were rather reed-like in character, but stout as those of birch trees, and which carried an almost flat roof of thick foliage. From this there hung fruits as smooth and bright and round as holly berries, some of which he ate. Then he found his way to open country near the skirts of the island, and looked about him. Neither Weston nor the lady was in sight, and he began walking in a leisurely fashion beside the sea. His bare feet sank a little into a carpet of saffron-coloured vegetation, which covered them with an aromatic dust. As he was looking down at this, he suddenly noticed something else. At first he thought it was a creature of more fantastic shape than he had yet seen on Perelandra. Its shape was not only fantastic, but hideous. Then he dropped on one knee to examine it. Finally he touched it, with reluctance. A moment later he drew back his hands like a man who had touched a snake. It was a damaged animal. It was, or had been, one of the brightly coloured frogs. But some accident had happened to it. The whole back had been ripped open in a sort of V-shaped gash, the point of the V being a little behind the head. Something had torn a widening wound backward, as we do in opening an envelope, along the trunk, and pulled it out so far behind the animal that the hoppers or hind legs had been almost torn off with it. They were so damaged that the frog could not leap. On earth it would have been merely a nasty sight, but up to this moment Ransom had as yet seen nothing dead or spoiled in Perelandra, and it was like a blow in the face. It was like the first spasm of well-remembered pain, warning a man who had thought he was cured that his family have deceived him and he is dying after all. It was like the first lie from the mouth of a friend on whose truth one was willing to stake £1,000. It was irrevocable. The milk-warm wind blowing over the golden sea, the blues and silvers and greens of the floating garden, the sky itself, all these had become, in one instant, merely the illuminated margin of a book whose text was the struggling little horror at his feet, and he himself, in that same instant, had passed into a state of emotion which he could neither control nor understand. He told himself that a creature of that kind probably had very little sensation, but it did not much mend matters. It was not merely pity for pain that had suddenly changed the rhythm of his heartbeats. The thing was an intolerable obscenity which afflicted him with shame. It would have been better, or so he thought at that moment, for the whole universe never to have existed.
Creatures, and sold all but 4 or 5. I guess that means I won in the end, at least in a financial sense. But in my heart, I stayed ashamed. I kept hearing Miss Heisler ask why I wanted to waste my talent, why I wanted to waste my time, why I wanted to write junk. Doing a serial story for Dave's Rag was fun, but my a snapshot than a memory. There is dust around the van's taillights. The license plate and the back windows are dirty. I register these things with no thought that I've been in an accident or of anything else. It's a snapshot, that's all. I'm not thinking. My head has been swapped clean. There's another little break in my memory here, and then I am very carefully wiping palmfuls of blood out of my eyes with my left hand. When my eyes are reasonably clear, I look around and see a man sitting on a nearby rock. He has a cane drawn across his lap. This is Brian Smith, 42 years of age, the man who hit me with his... And I never stopped writing. Some of the stuff that came out was tentative and flat, but at least it was there. I buried those unhappy, lackluster pages in the bottom drawer of my desk and got on to the next project. Little by little, I found the beat again, and after that I found the joy again. I came back to my family with gratitude and back to my work with relief. I came back to it the way folks come back to a summer cottage after a long winter, checking first to make sure nothing has been stolen or broken during the cold season. Nothing had been. It was still all there, still all whole. Once the pipes were thawed out and the electricity was turned, their journalistic duties bored me. Still, I had worked for a newspaper of sorts. Word got around, and during my sophomore year at Lisbon High, I became editor of our school newspaper, The Drum. I don't recall being given any choice in this matter. I think I was simply appointed. My second-in-command, Danny Emond, had even less interest in the paper than I did. Danny just liked the idea that room 4, where we did our work, was near the girls' bathroom. "Someday I'll just go crazy and hack my way in there, Steve," he told me on more than one occasion. "Hack, hack, hack." Once, he added, perhaps in an effort to justify himself, "the prettiest..." Also working out the actual narrative flow, which involved 2 supporting characters placing a bomb in a major character's closet. But that was mostly out of a sense of this is too good to be true unbelief. Too good or not, I knew it was true at the moment of revelation. That bomb in Nick Andros's closet was going to solve all my narrative problems. It did, too. The rest of the book ran itself off in 9 weeks. Later, when my first draft of The Stand was done, I was able to get a better fix on what had stopped me so completely in mid-course. It was a lot easier to think without that voice in the middle of my head constantly yammering, "I'm losing my book! Put your vocabulary on the top shelf of your toolbox, and don't make any conscious effort to improve it. You'll be doing that as you read, of course, but that comes later. One of the really bad things you can do to your writing is to dress up the vocabulary, looking for long words because you're maybe a little bit ashamed of your short ones. This is like dressing up a household pet in evening clothes. The pet is embarrassed, and the person who committed this act of premeditated cuteness should be even more embarrassed. Make yourself a solemn promise right now that you'll never use emolument when you mean tip, and you'll never say John stopped long enough to perform an act of excretion when you mean John stopped long enough. Man, Smith has got quite the driving record. He has racked up nearly a dozen vehicle-related offenses. Smith wasn't looking at the road on the afternoon our lives came together because his Rottweiler had jumped from the very rear of his van into the back seat area where there was an igloo cooler with some meat stored inside. The Rottweiler's name is Bullet. Smith has another Rottweiler at home. That one is named Pistol. Bullet started to nose at the lid of the cooler. Smith turned around and tried to push Bullet away. He was still looking at Bullet and pushing his head away from the cooler when he came over the top of the knoll. Still looking and pushing. Ah, shit, 500 pages and I'm losing my book. Condition red, condition red. I was also able to analyze what got me going again and appreciate the irony of it. I saved my book by blowing approximately half of its major characters to smithereens. There actually ended up being two explosions, the one in Boulder balanced by a similar act of sabotage in Las Vegas. The real source of my malaise, I decided, had been that in the wake of the plague, my Boulder characters, the good guys, were starting up the same old technological death trip. The first hesitant CB broadcasts beckoning people to Boulder would soon lead to TV. Back on, everything worked fine. The last thing I want to tell you in this part is about my desk. For years, I dreamed of having the sort of massive oak slab that would dominate a room. No more child's desk in a trailer laundry closet. No more cramped knee hole in a rented house. In 1981, I got the one I wanted and placed it in the middle of a spacious skylighted study. It's a converted stable loft at the rear of the house. For 6 years, I sat behind that desk either drunk or wrecked out of my mind, like a ship's captain in charge of a voyage to nowhere. A year or so after I sobered up, I got rid of that in school, pull up their skirts in there. This struck me as so fundamentally stupid, it might actually be wise, like a Zen koan or an early story by John Updike. The Drum did not prosper under my editorship. Then, as now, I tend to go through periods of idleness, followed by periods of workaholic frenzy. In the school year 1963-1964, The Drum published just one issue, but that one was a monster thicker than the Lisbon Falls telephone book. One night, sick to death of class reports, cheerleading updates, and some lame brain's efforts to write a school poem, I created a satiric high school to take a shit. If you believe take a shit would be considered offensive or inappropriate by your audience, feel free to say that John stopped long enough to move his bowels, or perhaps John stopped long enough to push. I'm not trying to get you to talk dirty, only plain and direct. Remember that the basic rule of vocabulary is use the first word that comes to your mind, if it's appropriate and colorful. If you hesitate and cogitate, you will come up with another word. Of course you will. There's always another word. But it probably won't be as good as your first one, or as close to what you really mean. This business of meaning is a very big deal. If you doubt it, think of all the time he struck me. Smith told friends later that he thought he'd hit a small deer until he noticed my bloody spectacles lying on the front seat of his van. They were knocked from my face when I tried to get out of Smith's way. The frames were bent and twisted, but the lenses were unbroken. They are the lenses I'm wearing now as I read this. Smith sees I'm awake and tells me help is on the way. He speaks calmly, even cheerily. His look, as he sits on his rock with his cane drawn across his lap, is one of pleasant commiseration. Ain't the two of us just had the shittiest luck, it says. He and Bullet left the key. Infomercials and 900 numbers would be back in no time. Same deal with the power plants. It certainly didn't take my Boulder folks long to decide that seeking the will of the God who spared them was a lot less important than getting the refrigerators and air conditioners up and running again. In Vegas, Randall Flagg and his friends were learning how to fly jets and bombers, as well as getting the lights back on, but that was okay, to be expected, because they were the bad guys. What had stopped me was realizing, on some level of my mind, that the good guys and bad guys were starting to look perilously alike. And what got me going again was realizing the good guys were worshipping an electronic golden school newspaper of my own when I should have been captioning photographs for The Drum. What resulted was a foresheet which I called The Village Vomit. The boxed motto in the upper left-hand corner was not "All the news that's fit to print," but "All the shit that will stick." That piece of dimwit humor got me into the only real trouble of my high school career. It also led me to the most useful writing lesson I ever got. In typical Mad Magazine style, what, me worry? I filled the vomit with fictional tidbits about the LHS faculty, using teacher nicknames the student body would immediately recognize. Thus, Miss Raypack, the study hall monstrosity, and put in a living room suite where it had been, picking out the pieces and a nice Turkish rug with my wife's help. In the early 90s, before they moved on to their own lives, my kids sometimes came up in the evening to watch a basketball game or a movie and eat pizza. They usually left a box full of crusts behind when they moved on, but I didn't care. They came, they seemed to enjoy being with me, and I know I enjoyed being with them. I got another desk. It's handmade, beautiful, and half the size of the T-Rex desk. I put it at the far west end of the office, in a corner, under the eave. That eave is very like the one I slept under F and needed a wake-up call. A bomb in the closet would do just fine. All this suggested to me that violence as a solution is woven through human nature like a damning red thread. That became the theme of the stand, and I wrote the second draft with it fixed firmly in my mind. Again and again, characters, the bad ones like Lloyd Henreid, as well as the good ones like Stu Redman and Larry Underwood, mention the fact that all that stuff, that is, weapons of mass destruction, is just lying around waiting to be picked up. When the Boulderites propose, innocently, meaning only the best, to rebuild the same old neon tower of times, you've heard someone say, "I just can't describe it," or, "That isn't what I mean." Think of all the times you've said those things yourself, usually in a tone of mild or serious frustration. The word is only a representation of the meaning. Even at its best, writing almost always falls short of full meaning. Given that, why in God's name would you want to make things worse by choosing a word which is only cousin to the one you really wanted to use? And do feel free to take appropriateness into account. As George Carlin once observed, in some company it's perfectly all right to prick your finger, but very bad form to finger your prick. Became Miss Rat Pack. Mr. Ricker, the college track English teacher and the school's most urbane faculty member, he looked quite a bit like Craig Stevens in Peter Gunn, became Cowman because his family owned Ricker Dairy. Mr. Deal, the earth science teacher, became Old Raw Deal. As all sophomoric humorists must be, I was totally blown away by my own wit. What a funny fellow I was. A regular Milltown H.L. Mencken. I simply must take the vomit to school and show all my friends. They would bust a collective gut. As a matter of fact, they did campground where they were staying, he later tells an investigator, because he wanted some of those Mises bars they have up to the stoa. When I hear this little detail some weeks later, it occurs to me that I have nearly been killed by a character right out of one of my own novels. It's almost funny. Help is on the way, I think, and that's probably good because I've been in a hell of an accident. I'm lying in the ditch, and there's blood all over my face, and my right leg hurts. I look down and see something I don't like. My lap now appears to be on sideways, as if my whole lower body had been wrenched half a turn to the right. I look in Durham, but there are no rats in the walls and no senile grandmother downstairs yelling for someone to feed Dick, the horse. I'm sitting under it now, a 53-year-old man with bad eyes, a gimp leg, and no hangover. I'm doing what I know how to do, and as well as I know how to do it. I came through all the stuff I told you about and plenty more I didn't, and now I'm going to tell you as much as I can about the job. As promised, it won't take long. It starts with this. Put your desk in the corner, and every time you sit down there to write, remind yourself why it isn't in the middle of the rabble. They are wiped out by more violence. The folks who plant the bomb are doing what Randall Flagg told them to, but Mother Abigail, Flagg's opposite number, says again and again that all things serve God. If this is true, and within the context of the stand it certainly is, then the bomb is actually a stern message from the guy upstairs, a way of saying, I didn't bring you all this way just so you could start up the same old shit. Near the end of the novel, it was the end of the first, shorter version of the story, Fran asks Stuart Redmond if there's any hope at all, if people ever learn from their mistakes. Stu replies, I don't know. Bust a collective gut. I had some good ideas about what tickled the funny bones of high school kids, and most of them were showcased in the Village Vomit. In one article, Cowman's prize jersey won a livestock farting contest at Topsom Fair. In another, old Raw Deal was fired for sticking the eyeballs of specimen fetal pigs up his nostrils. Humor in the grand Swiftian manner, you see. Pretty sophisticated, eh? During period four, three of my friends were laughing so hard in the back of study hall that Miss Raypack, Rat Pack to you, chum, crept up on them to see what was so funny. She confiscated. You'll also want grammar on the top shelf of your toolbox, and don't annoy me with your moans of exasperation or your cries that you don't understand grammar. You never did understand grammar. You flunked that whole semester in sophomore English. Writing is fun, but grammar sucks, the big one. Relax. Chill. We won't spend much time here because we don't need to. One either absorbs the grammatical principles of one's native language in conversation and in reading, or one does not. What sophomore English does, or tries to do, is little more than the naming of parts. And this isn't high school. Now that you're not worried that...
You, he said, tell her all. What good came to you? Do you rejoice that Maleldil became a man? Tell her of your joys, and of what profit you had when you made Maleldil and death acquainted. In the moment that followed this speech, two things happened that were utterly unlike terrestrial experience. The body that had been Weston's threw up its head and opened its mouth and gave a long, melancholy howl like a dog, and the lady lay down, wholly unconcerned, and closed her eyes and was instantly asleep. And while these two things were happening, the piece of ground on which the two men stood and the woman lay was rushing down a great hillside of water. Ransom kept his eyes fixed upon the enemy, but it took no notice of him. Its eyes moved like the eyes of a living man, but it was hard to be sure what it was looking at, or whether it really used the eyes as organs of vision at all. One got the impression of a force that cleverly kept the pupils of those eyes fixed in a suitable direction while the mouth talked, but which, for its own purpose, used wholly different modes of perception. The thing sat down close to the lady's head on the far side of her from Ransom. If you could call it sitting down. The body did not reach its squatting position by the normal movements of a man. It was more as if some external force maneuvered it into the right position and then let it drop. It was impossible to point to any particular motion which was definitely non-human. Ransom had the sense of watching an imitation of living motions which had been very well studied and was technically correct, but somehow it lacked the master touch. And he was chilled with an inarticulate night-nursery horror of the thing he had to deal with, the managed corpse, the bogey, the unman. There was nothing to do but watch, to sit there, forever if need be, guarding the lady from the unman while their island climbed interminably over the Alps and Andes of burnished water. All three were very still. Beasts and birds came often and looked upon them. Hours later, the unman began to speak. It did not even look in Ransom's direction. Slowly and cumbrously, as if by some machinery that needed oiling, it made its mouth and lips pronounce his name. Ransom, it said. Well, said Ransom. Nothing, said the unman. He shot an inquisitive glance at it. Was the creature mad? But it looked, as before, dead rather than mad, sitting there with the head bowed and the mouth a little open, and some yellow dust from the moss settled in the creases of its cheeks, and the legs crossed, tailor-wise, and the hands, with their long, metallic-looking nails, pressed flat together on the ground before it. He dismissed the problem from his mind and returned to his own uncomfortable thoughts. "Ransom," it said again. "What is it?" said Ransom sharply.
Nothing, it answered.
Again there was silence, and again, about a minute later, the horrible mouth said,
Ransom.
This time he made no reply. Another minute, and it uttered his name again, and then, like a minute gun,
Ransom, Ransom, Ransom,
perhaps 100 times. What the hell do you want? He roared at last.
Nothing, said the voice.
Next time he determined not to answer, but when it had called on him about 1,000 times, he found himself answering whether he would or no, and
nothing,
came the reply. He taught himself to keep silent in the end. Not that the torture of resisting his impulse to speak was less than the torture of response, but because something within him rose up to combat the tormentor's assurance that he must yield in the end. If the attack had been of some more violent kind, it might have been easier to resist. What chilled and almost cowed him was the union of malice with something nearly childish. For temptation, for blasphemy, for a whole battery of horrors, he was in some sort prepared. But hardly for this petty, indefatigable nagging as of a nasty little boy at a preparatory school. Indeed, no imagined horror could have surpassed the sense which grew within him as the slow hours passed, that this creature was, by all human standards, inside out, its heart on the surface, and its shallowness at the heart. On the surface, great designs and an antagonism to heaven which involved the fate of worlds. But deep within, when every veil had been pierced, was there, after all, nothing but a black puerility, an aimless, empty spitefulness, content to sate itself with the tiniest cruelties, as love does not disdain the smallest kindness? What kept him steady long after all possibility of thinking about something else had disappeared was the decision that if he must hear either the word ransom or the word nothing 1,000,000 times, he would prefer the word ransom. And all the time the little jewel-coloured land went soaring up into the yellow firmament and hung there a moment and tilted its woods and went racing down into the warm, lustrous depths between the waves. And the lady lay sleeping with one arm bent beneath her head and her lips a little parted. Sleeping, assuredly, for her eyes were shut and her breathing regular, yet not looking quite like those who sleep in our world, for her face was full of expression and intelligence, and the limbs looked as if they were ready at any moment to leap up. And altogether she gave the impression that sleep was not a thing that happened to her, but an action which she performed. Then all at once it was night.
Ransom, 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 went on the voice.
And suddenly it crossed his mind that though he would sometime require sleep, the unman might not. Chapter 10. Sleep proved to be indeed the problem. For what seemed a great time, cramped and wearied and soon hungry and thirsty as well, he sat still in the darkness, trying not to attend to the unflagging repetition of ransom, ransom, ransom. But presently he found himself listening to a conversation of which he knew he had not heard the beginning, and realized that he had slept. The lady seemed to be saying very little. Weston's voice was speaking gently and continuously. It was not talking about the fixed land, nor even about Maleldil. It appeared to be telling, with extreme beauty and pathos, a number of stories, and at first Ransom could not perceive any connecting link between them. They were all about women, but women who had apparently lived at different periods of the world's history, and in quite different circumstances. From the lady's replies, it appeared that the stories contained much that she did not understand. But oddly enough, the unman did not mind. If the questions aroused by any one story proved at all difficult to answer, the speaker simply dropped that story and instantly began another. The heroines of the story seemed all to have suffered a great deal. They had been oppressed by fathers, cast off by husbands, deserted by lovers. Their children had risen up against them, and society had driven them out. But the stories all ended, in a sense, happily, sometimes with honours and praises to a heroine still living, more often with tardy acknowledgement and unavailing tears after her death. As the endless speech proceeded, the lady's questions grew always fewer. Some meaning for the words death and sorrow, though what kind of meaning Ransom could not even guess, was apparently being created in her mind by mere repetition. At last it dawned upon him what all these stories were about. Each one of these women had stood forth alone and braved a terrible risk for her child, her lover, or her people. Each had been misunderstood, reviled, and persecuted, but each also magnificently vindicated by the event. The precise details were often not very easy to follow. Ransom had more than a suspicion that many of these noble pioneers had been what, in ordinary terrestrial speech, we call witches or perverts. But that was all in the background. What emerged from the stories was rather an image than an idea. The picture of the tall, slender form, unbowed, though the world's weight rested upon its shoulders, stepping forth fearless and friendless into the dark to do for others what those others forbade it to do, yet needed to have done. And all the time, as a sort of background to these goddess shapes, the speaker was building up a picture of the other sex. No word was directly spoken on the subject, but one felt them there as a huge, dim multitude of creatures, pitifully childish and complacently arrogant. Timid, meticulous, unoriginating, sluggish and ox-like, rooted to the earth almost in their indolence, prepared to try nothing, to risk nothing, to make no exertion, and capable of being raised into full life only by the unthanked and rebellious virtue of their females. It was very well done. Ransom, who had little of the pride of sex, found himself for a few moments all but believing it. In the midst of this, the darkness was suddenly torn by a flash of lightning. A few seconds later came a revel of Perelandrian thunder, like the playing of a heavenly tambourine, and after that, warm rain. Ransom did not much regard it. The flash had shown him the unman sitting bolt upright, the lady raised on one elbow, the dragon lying awake at her head, a grove of trees beyond, and great waves against the horizon. He was thinking of what he had seen. He was wondering how the lady could see that face, those jaws monotonously moving as if they were rather munching than talking, and not know the creature to be evil. He saw, of course, that this was unreasonable of him. He himself was doubtless an uncouth figure in her eyes. She could have no knowledge either about evil or about the normal appearance of terrestrial man to guide her. The expression on her face, revealed in the sudden light, was one that he had not seen there before. Her eyes were not fixed on the narrator. As far as that went, her thoughts might have been 1,000 miles away. Her lips were shut and a little pursed. Her eyebrows were slightly raised. He had not yet seen her look so like a woman of our own race, and yet her expression was one he had not very often met on Earth, except, as he realized with a shock, on the stage. Like a tragedy queen was the disgusting comparison that arose in his mind. Of course, it was a gross exaggeration. It was an insult for which he could not forgive himself. And yet, the tableau revealed by the lightning had photographed itself on his brain. Do what he would, he found it impossible not to think of that new look in her face. A very good tragedy queen, no doubt. The heroine of a very great tragedy, very nobly played by an actress who was a good woman in real life. By earthly standards, an expression to be praised, even to be revered. But remembering all that he had read in her countenance before, the unself-conscious radiance, the frolic sanctity, the depth of stillness that reminded him sometimes of infancy and sometimes of extreme old age, while the hard youth and valiancy of face and body denied both, he found this new expression horrifying. The fatal touch of invited grandeur, of enjoyed pathos, the assumption, however slight, of a role, seemed a hateful vulgarity. Perhaps she was doing no more, he had good hope that she was doing no more, than responding in a purely imaginative fashion to this new art of story or poetry. But by God, she'd better not. And for the first time the thought, "This can't go on," formulated itself in his mind. "I will go where the leaves cover us from the rain," said her voice in the darkness. Ransom had hardly noticed that he was getting wet. In a world without clothes, it is less important. But he rose when he heard her move and followed her as well as he could by ear. The unmanned seemed to be doing the same. They progressed in total darkness on a surface as variable as that of water. Every now and then there was another flash. One saw the lady walking erect, the unmanned slouching by her side, with Weston's shirt and shorts now sodden and clinging to it, and the dragon puffing and waddling behind. At last they came to a place where the carpet under their feet was dry, and there was a drumming noise of rain on firm leaves above their heads. They lay down again.
"'And another time,' began the unman at once, "'there was a queen in our world who ruled over a little land.'
"'Hush,' said the lady. "'Let us listen to the rain.'
Then, after a moment, she added,
"'What was that?'
"'It was some beast I never heard before.' And indeed, there had been something very like a low growl close beside them. "'I do not know,' said the voice of Weston.
"'I think I do,' said Ransom.
"'Hush!' said the lady again, and no more was said that night. This was the beginning of a series of days and nights which Ransom remembered with loathing for the rest of his life. He had been only too correct in supposing that his enemy required no sleep. Fortunately, the lady did, but she needed a good deal less than Ransom, and possibly, as the days passed, came to take less than she needed. It seemed to Ransom that whenever he dozed, he awoke to find the unman already in conversation with her. He was dead tired. He could hardly have endured it at all, but for the fact that their hostess quite frequently dismissed them both from her presence. On such occasions, Ransom kept close to the unman. It was a rest from the main battle, but it was a very imperfect rest. He did not dare to let the enemy out of his sight for a moment, and every day its society became more unendurable. He had full opportunity to learn the falsity of the maxim that the Prince of Darkness is a gentleman. Again and again he felt that a suave and subtle Mephistopheles with red cloak and rapier and a feather in his cap, or even a sombre, tragic Satan out of Paradise Lost, would have been a welcome release from the thing he was actually doomed to watch. It was not like dealing with a wicked politician at all. It was much more like being set to guard an imbecile or a monkey or a very nasty child. What had staggered and disgusted him when it first began saying, "Ransom, Ransom," continued to disgust him every day and every hour. It showed plenty of subtlety and intelligence when talking to the lady, but Ransom soon perceived that it regarded intelligence simply and solely as a weapon, which it had no more wish to employ in its off-duty hours than a soldier has to do bayonet practice when he is on leave. Thought was for it a device necessary to certain ends, but thought in itself did not interest it. It assumed reason as externally and inorganically as it had assumed Weston's body. The moment the lady was out of sight, it seemed to relapse. A great deal of his time was spent in protecting the animals from it. Whenever it got out of sight, or even a few yards ahead, it would make a grab at any beast or bird within its reach and pull out some fur or feathers. Ransom tried whenever possible to get between it and its victim. On such occasions there were nasty moments when the two stood facing each other. It never came to a fight, for the unman merely grinned and perhaps spat and fell back a little. But before that happened, Ransom usually had opportunity to discover how terribly he feared it. For side by side with his disgust, the more childlike terror of living with a ghost or a mechanized corpse never left him for many minutes together. The fact of being alone with it sometimes rushed upon his mind with such dismay that it took all his reason to resist his longing for society, his impulse to rush madly over the island until he found the lady and to beg her protection. When the unman could not get animals, it was content with plants. It was fond of cutting their outer rinds through with its nails, or grubbing up roots, or pulling off leaves, or even tearing up handfuls of turf. With Ransom himself, it had innumerable games to play. It had a whole repertory of obscenities to perform with its own, or rather with Weston's, body. And the mere silliness of them was almost worse than the dirtiness. It would sit making grimaces at him for hours together, and then, for hours more, it would go back to its old repetition of